Tunnel Vision 3. We're going to wrap up a little bit on what our actual vision is. And, you know, the more you think about this stuff, the more you're going to realize that we didn't cover some things, some major things. Yesterday we talked a lot about, you know, the sort of court system and that kind of thing. We didn't talk anything about whether there would be overarching courts like the Supreme Court system and that sort of stuff.
Could you give just a really short version, like wrap up of, because I haven't been to either of the previous, and I know that's bad planning, but
you want to wrap up on the legal system, huh?
Like a 30-second.
No, but let's. Well, I mean, a bit of review is in order. So what we've talked about so far is we've elaborated the values that we'd like this system to be based on, and they're still going to come into play when we're talking about strategy, and we'll talk about why. But
that's going to be a vanguard of peace. That's no fun.
Can I get through a little bit here? Thanks. we're going to. So the values that we've talked about are the ones that overlap with participatory economics, self-management, solidarity, equity, and diversity. And we talked about a couple or three extras, including peace as a possible value, some version of that. We talked about liberty as a value. And we talked about free association and how that will be pretty important in being able to ensure that, you know, I mean, people are where they need to be. People are in the systems where they need. And then when we talked about sort of as the social contract concept of, if you're going to establish a so-called justice system, you know, there may be to some extent a need for people to say, okay, well, if I'm living in this community, I'm going to follow by these rules, and that's sort of the contract that's there. We don't necessarily escape that by having an anarchist or anarchistic vision. So we talked about legislative bodies, direct democracy at the community level, and then how those bodies go beyond. We talked about a few different NATO decision-making methods that if you missed it, then you're not going to know how to make decisions from now on. Another one that I want to address today that I think is kind of interesting. And then we talked about new forms of policing. We talked about adjustments or significant adjustments that could be made to the sort of current conception of a court system in order to ensure that we don't have overly aggressive prosecution, that we have fair trials. And then we talked about what do we do with people who have been convicted of a crime, the philosophy of punishment, and those sorts of things. some part of this was hilarious, I guess. It's the last day. It's really going to be... It's okay. It's all right. It's only slightly disconcerting. So today we want to talk about information in a free society, because information is one of the most dangerous elements in society if freedom isn't guaranteed, and the ability to seek out information and provide information isn't guaranteed, we're going to run into a problem. And no matter what kind of systems we put in place, economic or political, without free information and the free sharing of ideas, education, media, etc., we're screwed. If we don't know what we're doing, then no matter what system is in place to do it through, we're going to act against our own interests. So to me, information and the sharing of information in society is all about guaranteeing that we have the ability to determine our own interests, that we have the ability to determine common interests through dialogue, through expression, and that we have the ability to act on that. And that's where the political system comes in, is once we've got that information. However, the political system also has to sort of maybe come in at certain points and make sure that we get that information. So the two key elements of information in a free society, information in any society, are going to be media, the communications media, and education. We're gonna have radically different approaches to these things in a new society, but some of the same problems could still possibly creep up. Okay, when we're talking about media, when we're talking about information, what's the most important element that we understand in this society and that we're going to look to in a free society?
Ability for everyone to have access.
Yeah, access and protection of
civil liberties.
Truth?
Freedom of speech.
Woo! Well, freedom of speech and the ability to arrive at a truth if there is one, or to be able to recognize multiple versions of truth and that sort of stuff. But yeah, the ability to get everything out there. And I think the basic thing is going to be a guarantee of free speech. Now, what's different about our free society and the sort of political system that we've been talking about, and what we sort of know we're headed toward through all these social changes in the different spheres and society today, and I'm particularly thinking of the government. Now, the government guarantees free speech so that who can't prohibit free speech?
The government
itself. So first of all, what we want to do is when we're building social institutions and political institutions in particular, those are the primary ones that will have the power to restrict free speech, especially with a participatory economy in place, where no matter even if we don't do anything to guarantee free speech and we don't do anything to sort of subsidize free speech, which we'll kind of be talking about in a minute, a participatory economy gives people access to be able to get a voice out to some extent. I'm not sure if it'll be sufficient, so we need to talk about some supplements. But really we're worried about a government prohibiting speech. We don't want a system that has the ability to do that. So that's an advantage. If we go into it building a system that doesn't have mechanisms for prevention of free speech, that's a big advantage. But I still think that the First Amendment type thing is still going to be relevant, that we're going to want a government that guarantees free speech. Comments on that? I know you've been dying to say something.
No, I haven't been dying to say anything.
Just kidding, yeah.
Just the one thing. I guess the idea of if there's intent to harm in speech, just in not in terms of like political ideas that aren't great, but in terms of running in, like the old idea, running into a theater and yelling fire, and because you like to see people get trampled, and you know the people, and you could, would that be protected by free speech, or would that be not protected by murder if you kill somebody?
Well, I don't have much of a critique of the most radical versions of our, you know, in the U.S., the understanding of what free speech is, actually. I don't know if anybody does, but, you know, it incorporates, okay, well, there are certain limitations.
And those would be judged by some sort of quorum anyway. I mean, in the new setup, there would be some body that looks to see, well, maybe you overstepped more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, would it be a hierarchy body?
No, but, I mean, it could be a group of people representing the community. Say they could be the community standards board that says, you know, maybe push it saying grab guns and kill folks. I don't know.
Well, certain things leave the bounds of, we aren't really worried about speech when it comes to organizing, you know, for harm. Mm-hmm. Right, organizing people get together with guns and whatever. I mean, it isn't that you said you wanted to do it, it's that you began to do it. I think some of these things leave the realm of speech, and you know. But there is the purely speech-oriented act of yelling fire in a crowded theater. Now, is this a common thing in our society? I mean, I don't remember the last time that happened. we use these hypotheticals to demonstrate, and it's good. We always use hypotheticals in order to, you know, these are the things that Noam Chomsky hates, right? He was really upset about this for some reason, but I think that he also responds to them very well. We need these. We need these exercises in what if, in order to demonstrate where the sort of limitations of our philosophy are, that's how we know that we need to patch something. Okay, so all these patches we've been talking about, you know, when we see that there's a hole in our political system or even our political philosophy, we've got to patch it somehow. Doesn't mean everything's going to come out neat and pretty, but generally we're heading in a particular direction, which is okay. Well, free speech needs to be guaranteed. The most important way to guarantee free speech is to not develop mechanisms which can prohibit free speech. Okay. I can only see your eyes.
Are you done with free speech now? Or are you gonna
talk? Yeah, we're never going to talk about it again. I was going to move on a little bit. Go ahead.
Well, I think the problem in the U.S. isn't that the government prevents free speech as much as that certain actors have way more.
Okay.
But that would be changed once we hit a participatory economy.
But not sufficiently. So yeah, that is the direction they're moving. How do we guarantee? Well, let's put it this way. Okay, let's look at a participatory economy. And I know that our understanding here for most folks who are just getting involved is there's so much that's being taken in, and it's really hard to picture how practical things would take place. But there would be media institutions. Newspaper publishers, you know, a whole range, radio, TV, everything.
I mean, under free speech, would there be any censorship?
No, that's my point, is that we can't have government censorship.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
Of of speech alone, you know, certain types of speech that are directly violent or whatever, you know, maybe. But I mean, that the point is that the government doesn't ever develop a mechanism to censor.
So there's no FCC.
Well, I mean, well, that's interesting because
they
that.
Or
right, I mean.
The
yeah, they regulate in all sorts of ways, but they're not just the censors. So would there be something akin to the FCC? Well, presumably we'd have something that actually did say, well, you know, we're going to assign frequencies, you know, for radio and television and whatever other kinds of broadcasts, right? So, I mean, there's nothing authoritarian about that if it's done in a way that people have access.
Right.
So any institution like that is going to be, and the FCC, if you look at the way it's designed, it's actually, it almost looks like the intent of it is to guarantee access. If you look at how that plays out in reality and how freaking hard it actually is to get access, that's where the difficulty is. So we rewrite that stuff. Some of these things are simple. When we look at the parallel version in our society of this institution, let's look where it came from. Congress designed that. Okay, Congress said, you all are going to go in and create this institution that can regulate this stuff. You know, Congress made sure that the people who did that were people who were going to be responsive to corporate interests, because that's what Congress's job is today. So in this society, we're going to have communities with direct democracy appointing and electing people to go in and make those decisions. It doesn't mean that it comes through a community forum that, you know, every time someone wants a radio station, we have to approve it, you know, and 70% of the population has to show up to vote and this and that. But we are going to, there's going to be some shorthand, but we're going to say we want direct accountability from the people who are making that decision. When we set up those institutions instead of Congress doing it, they will be different. It doesn't mean that some of the functions aren't similar, but they won't have the power to censor, which the FCC does have today. This is my guess, right? I mean, this is my hope for what we could do. But it's interesting because we might actually have to have institutions that complement where the economy lacks. And where does the economy lack? Well, your speech has to be valued in order for the economy to provide you access. All right, it's pretty easy to get your speech valued if you can get people to start hearing you, but you're not going to be able to publish a newspaper in a participatory economy if nobody yet has any interest in it, unless the participatory economy decides that it does value dissent, which we don't have any reason to necessarily believe is going to be the case, because we're looking at material conditions, we're looking at material factors and economic factors, and some of these political factors don't necessarily play out in the economy. When we go into the polity, we put our political hats on, and that's where we're going to start realizing some of these things that are more philosophical and more political than they are economic. So maybe the polity is where we come up with an institution that actually seeks out dissent, that actually plays devil's advocate, that actually supports or funds, you know, the ability to get some of those words out, or even the ability to just discuss alternative ideas.
I have a question. In a free market economy, there's the ideology that any intrusion on the free market from the political sphere is damaging to the economy. So what, in terms of participatory economics, does an intrusion from the political sphere, what effect does that have on the way that the system will function?
If we have, this could have come up at any point, and I'm surprised that people haven't actually said exactly that. I mean, what we're designing, and remember, I talked about this in Political Vision 1, I think in each of the classes it was mentioned to some extent. What we're realizing is that when we get to politics, we look at that and it's a unique sphere because most of what politics might end up having to do is make up for the slack from what hasn't been done in the other spheres, right? So when we look at violence between people, when we look at the way societies relate to one another even, when we look at possibly having to check the economy's ability to violate our ethical, ecological principles and things like that. In every instance, really what we're seeing is that the polity is stepping in where those spheres are not adequate, where the institutions in those spheres are not adequate to yield the results that we really do want, that we on some formal level know we want. So that's where the value of having the political system be able to step in is. When we get to strategy, we're going to realize how it we're going to highlight the ways, the concerns that we actually have about political manipulation of these other institutions, be it economic or kinship or cultural. I mean, we'll actually get to those first when we talk about education. So our political system needs to be kept in check, and it needs to be able to keep itself in check, okay? But it is in turn used primarily to keep other institutions in check as well. So if the participatory economy is not able to guarantee free speech, and by that I don't just mean that you can say whatever you want, but you can have people hear it. You can have people see it in a newspaper. You can have people here and there. Doesn't mean even that we're going to step into other institutions and say, your television station has to let this wacko, which maybe the person is, express their ideas. But what we do have to do is find a way that those ideas can get out there, because in our society we have to, and we have to do this now on the left, and we'll have to do it in the future until the end of history, we will have to make sure that every idea can have its day. Otherwise we have no reason to believe that ours are correct, or that ours are, you know, preferable even, okay? So that's what the political system might have to do in this situation. It might have to actually have an institution, seeks out dissent, even instigates dissent, and we have a devil's advocate institution of some kind that says we're going to have some kind of funding from the polity that people have set aside to make sure that everybody with a crazy idea can have some degree of access. The economy might say it's wasteful. The economy is going to say, you know what, if we print newspapers for these idiots, you know, if we have Idiot Weekly, it's a disaster. Everything, it offsets everything. Nobody wants their consumption moved there. But in a political setting, we can look at that and say, we value that so much that we need to subsidize it. We need to subsidize dissent. And that would be an indication of a radical society that I think that would be a major factor in, as simple as it sounds, recognizing that a society is really, really doing something amazing. And to the extent that societies have guaranteed that, you know, third parties and dissident parties are funded and all sorts of stuff like that, that's where we can start to see that there actually is some radicalism going on. There actually is some belief in something that could truly be called self-management and free speech.
Now I have one more question about that to follow up.
I knew you would.
Does that mean also that people would be doing that as their job? Like, they would be pursuing dissident speech, like... So not only is it economically wasteful in the first place, but then they're also being, not only are they being provided the resources, but they're being remunerated for it as well.
Oh, well, you might not get remunerated for being a wacko, no. But you do get, you probably would get remunerated for being the person who seeks out the wackos.
Actually, I just wanted to answer that. Could
please do.
That? Because you said, what constitutes an intrusion from the polity? The only sacred things about the party con are the balanced job complexes, you know, the planning process that everyone's involved in, mm-hmm. and the councils. So if the polity interferes in those things, that's probably a problem. But mm-hmm. otherwise, I would think not. Like, if it acts to unbalanced job complexes, that would be.
Well, because it's, at a certain point, I could see it as happening. If you have to cut down too many trees and involve people in work that's too onerous to provide resources for everybody who has, you know, an axe to grind, then I can
right.
see it as really making, you know, damaging the economic system. I just wonder, like,
well,
how that
well, yeah, and not only that, but no one else has this sort of special attention to advocacy of their speech. So in other words, the majorities who are 9 times out of 10 going to prove to be the ones who, you know, who had the preferable opinion on a certain issue or whatever, you know, because we do have all this access to media and this kind of thing, and it is fairly likely that in most cases the best options are going to be generated and encouraged early on. Those people don't have any kind of special treatment. And the polity doesn't say, well, we're going to make sure that if we give a tiny dissident minority special, you know, attention and access, that we're going to give you any. So there has to be a constraint on this. Well, it's not that difficult, though. As soon as a dissident minority gains enough momentum that they are going to be acknowledged by the economy and they are going to be given access, which is going to happen, because the economy is never going to say, this is against our interests. This idea is against our interests. Even things like balanced job complexes being challenged. No, the economy doesn't have a way to care about that. The economy can only respond to actual inputs. It can't respond to ideology, because there's not enough control to have their opinions say, oh, this offends my sensibilities.
Not only that, but nobody's going to want to spend their entire life working hard doing something that has absolutely no meaning. So.
Okay. I don't.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
yeah. Well.
Because that's the question.
That's
I raised,
a given.
I realize that nobody's. I mean, you're not going to have millions of people deciding
right.
to put out dissent
so,
papers advocating bullshit.
But you might. You might. And I don't see why not. I don't see why, personally, I'm not even sure that this isn't something that wouldn't appeal to me. I mean, I might want to be, I mean, look at it, this is what I do. I do dissent. If we suddenly win, I want a job, you know, like I want something that like I have skills in, which so far has only been raising hell. So I might go and I might be like, well, say, so we won and my political vision ideas are now everywhere in sight. And I still might go, well, I want to go over and see what these guys are thinking, you know, like what are they generating? I don't see why not. It's a wonderful part of democracy is that when dissidents are given attention and actually given respect, and on occasion they're actually going to be right, and on occasion they're going to prove that this system, that this makes sense, this kind of function, and that's what's going to maintain their value. That's when we're going to recognize, you know, well, 50 times out of 51, these people are, you know, the people that are given attention by these special institutions are completely off their rocker, but once in a while they come up with something incredible, and because that was guaranteed access, we all realized that, and it did change something. So that's going to be recognized in a political, or the economy may not recognize that on its own.
But we don't even want balanced job complexes to be completely sacred, because that might not always make sense.
Yes, we do.
Well, we want, okay, well, okay, no, wait.
I'll give you, like, I mean, say there are a specific group of surgeons who are highly skilled, and there's some massive outbreak and everyone's dying. We're not going to be like, that's all empowering work you're doing as a surgeon.
That's already incorporated in the economic system. But let's, for hypothetically, let's say that someday we decide the balanced job complex isn't the way to go, and we'll get to this as strategy. But the political system is not the place that the changes are made, right? They're made within the economy. So that's not the economy has to have its own structures to guarantee that it can mold with social opinion. Yeah, right. Yeah, go. He has to have an answer for that one. What we also want to identify when we talk about information, before we move on to the education part of this, free speech and self-management may be the two key factors, the two key elements in a society or in a community that another community is going to look at when they say, we want to affiliate with you in some sort of federated manner. So when we're talking about building those sort of next-level polities that incorporate multiple communities or multiple regions, etc., they may not have to do everything exactly the same. They certainly won't have to agree on everything. But the guarantee that people in those societies have information, have access to information and free education and free communications, and that they have self-management, regardless of what they do with those. See, this is what I want to highlight here, is that what you do with the information is one thing. If you have the ability to do it through democratic structures and you have, you know, a breadth of information, this could be one of the key factors. The way societies and communities set up their information systems may be the criteria that other societies and other communities are going to judge them by. Any comments on this stuff so far?
Just as a tactic, one of the things that might work would be to have just these open and controlled forums where anything goes and anybody can say anything they want. And then if you find a dissident is getting a lot of attention at that point, that might be the point at which
Or that even the opinion exists.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just gonna say, kind of as part of what you were saying earlier, I think it's really important for us to incorporate structures where there can be like the idea of the dialectic, like to not necessarily opposing ideas, but you know, coming closer to the truth. But I mean, because we don't want to have our ideas just like in a vacuum and they're never being, you know, challenged. And I mean, I do think that there's certain things that we do hold sacred, but I mean, one of the things that's such a problem now is that, you know, certain people are controlling what they hold sacred, and anything that challenges that is suppressed. And I feel like we don't want to keep that. So I think it's really important for us to, you know, incorporate dialectic type stuff.
Cool. Speaking of which, education. So. So if guarantee of free speech and sort of access to information is going to be a major component of the political system when it comes to media, what about education? Same thing?
More so.
Come on, yell it out. Yeah, more so?
More so.
Okay.
I think you'd want people, because if you have a group of people that are more educated, then you're less likely to get into situations where people want to be dissidents for dissidents' sake, or, you know what I mean, like just to come out with some crackpot idea for the sake of doing it. If you have the respect for knowledge, you're going to come with what you think is the best idea all the time because you respect the fact that you're doing it. You know what I mean? Like scientific theory. You know what I mean? Like people have, you don't have scientists that fund. Well, that's wrong. You do have scientists that fund projects, but okay. Well, I think education's a better idea anyway because it would help.
He's going to backtrack to something.
Yeah. I'll help you finish my own conversation. I'll be back.
Right on. Right on. Well, anyway, so the guarantee of access to educational opportunities, and the guarantee of every idea that comes up about, you know, we want to educate, we want to offer this as something that we educate people on, that kind of stuff can get funded as well, even when it's very, very minor. So it's a very similar approach to the media, and possibly even just looking at it as another form of media in some instances.
So we should fund, like, we should have classes that are, like,
well,
nobody will go. But
yeah. Nobody will go. I don't know how this will play out and what certain things we will, but when there is, yeah, I mean, I don't see why not.
I mean, just because you learn about something doesn't mean you subscribe to it.
Yeah.
Right.
And I doubt you'll have many people who are going to want to teach pro-capitalism.
Right. Our free association principle is kicking in here, and we're going, you know. And well, actually, this is really, I mean, but that's really important. The free association thing comes in way, way when we talk about, you all right there, Tim?
Yeah.
When we talk about educational opportunities and that kind of thing. We want to guarantee a diversity of educational forums. Forums meaning the types, the institutions and the different kinds of methods we use to learn. The problem is that if we say we want open curriculum type situations, you know, where all sorts of things can be taught and there's a huge diversity there, but we don't have the different kinds of ways people learn facilitated, then we're going to have a problem. So it doesn't matter, you know, to the best of our ability, and here we have to kind of answer to the economy, but we might also have to pull the economy along a little bit and say, well, even though it's very expensive to educate certain people in a certain way, this is the way they educate best. And it doesn't, I don't mean that they all say, well, we want education on the beach. And that's what we mean. That can get expensive. We want education in an airplane. These things are expensive. But if it does mean that certain people, and especially, again, I will get back to the issue of disabilities. People need access to the way that they learn best. And this is going to kick the economy in the ass. There may be tiny minorities that learn best in ways that are very expensive. But if we really want a society that's broadly, you know, empowered intellectually, then we're going to have to make sure that everybody gets to learn as best we can, as best as they need to. Restrictions on compulsion—that's going to be another thing. And here we're going to start to see where we bleed into a couple of the other spheres, particularly kinship, where families are, and culture, where religion in particular, and ethnicity. Churches and families getting involved and saying, my student or my child is going to learn this. And here, this is one of the most radical statements, I think, one of the boldest statements I'm going to make in this class is that can't be allowed. That you cannot force your own children to learn anything, and that you might not even be allowed to control the education of your own children. This, right? So, you know, y'all skipped youth liberation, so... No, but this is where that plays out very strongly. The idea that in order to have libertarian education, we have to have a diversity of options, and everybody has to be guaranteed those.
But how does this respect different cultures?
Because every culture has the option to. Because cultures can still do all the education that they want to. You can't force people to participate in your culture.
But
it does that. Does that respect cultures?
Born,
it doesn't respect our current concept of culture.
But the
you're born into a family, so the fuck what?
I'm
born into a dictatorship, that means I deserve
to have,
you know.
The intercommunalist principle, even, you know, as the Panthers had it, was that you have the right to leave.
But you can't say you respect culture and then determine what culture is like, allowable.
Yeah. No,
Jesse,
no, no, no. I see this. Well, but it, go ahead.
Well, children.
Right. Well, that's yeah. I'm sorry. I should have said that.
I may feel this may sound paternalistic, but like what some kids don't actually know what's in their own best interest, like especially at a young age.
Like a 4-year-old.
I mean, it's kind of hard to say. Like, okay, you're 5. You're starting school now, so you get to do whatever you want, and it's kind of like that seems. I mean. I can understand, okay, but most kids don't have the foresight and wisdom to know that this is what's going to be best for me, and I don't know.
So the fuck what?
Unlike teachers who tell them what will be the best for them, but, and they get...
Yeah, wait.
Don't
want to
learn how to read.
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, you're absolutely right. When 5-year-olds don't know what to choose to learn, if you compare it on a scale that we just have made, 5-year-olds are not ready to learn to read, and they won't want to learn to read. In this society, we decide that at 5, you start to learn to read. It's against every sort of, you know, natural inclination the child has. It actually is, in general. I mean, not every 5-year-old, but studies have demonstrated over and over again. If you let kids decide when they want to learn to read, they'll learn to read 9 years old. The people who read best years later are the people who started to read when they were 9 years old. This isn't really a science. This is just about liberty. This is the issue of if a good society, the society that we want, is one where we have to start manipulating and manufacturing children at an early age, well, fuck it. I don't even want to participate in that. If we can say, you know what, let's step back and let people figure out what they want to learn, and it isn't going to destroy our society. I mean, is it? Is there a problem with letting kids freely associate and decide what they want to learn?
Especially when you're giving them all kinds of options.
Right. They have every option to learn.
I see the direction you're going in, but I guess like the problem I've always had with our society right now is it pretends everyone's a child that needs to be led. But sometimes I think you can pretend that children are children. Like, I think at a certain point there are some choices that are inappropriate to give kids, especially ones that like in broad like the reading thing. I agree with you, but I think there are to an extent a family can have a top-down structure of a sort in which kids aren't given. Like, the process of growing up is the process of being kept safe as you learn to make your own decisions responsibly. Mm-hmm.
Did someone hear in what I said that we're going to put children in fires or ovens or something?
I didn't say that.
You know, I mean, this isn't... All I'm saying is that if we decide that children's... that the way a child is going to grow up is going to be defined and constrained by who their parents are, then we're fucked. And not only this, but we can't even make change this way. We can't. All we do is perpetuate ourselves. Right, a parent can say, "There's all these educational options out there, but you don't get to access them." And if every parent has that power, I mean, first of all, it's just purely authoritarian. Second of all, there's no. I mean, what we're doing is we're saying that okay, well, a child can't decide what he or she wants to do, but that a parent somehow is so much better at doing that. Then why don't we hand that role over to the parents? No, society decides what opportunities are available, and then children are allowed to freely pursue them. This doesn't ever say that. At any particular culture or any particular familial style or even perspectives on things like gender, you know, patriarchal perspectives on gender can't be taught. What it says is you can't force anybody to learn them.
So do we respect cultures up to the point until they abridge the freedom of others? Like, say, for instance, a culture that demands to be able to raise their children the way they want to? Like, do we not respect that?
That's an element of every culture, and it isn't a culturally distinct thing. There's very few cultures that say, oh, it's part of our culture to encourage people to seek out other cultures. There are some, oddly, but they're in the minority. That isn't a cultural thing. That's every kind of institution has a tendency toward that, and so cultures are just one element of that. Where you know, they're all going to want that, but you can't say, well, we're not respecting diversity. If we don't allow a culture, you might say we're not respecting a diversity if we don't allow cultures to kill people. There you could actually make an argument that we're not respecting diversity because their morality says they get to kill people. But every culture's morality is going to include that our children get brought up in this culture.
Yeah.
And that's different. It isn't a culturally specific thing, and therefore it is something that we can impinge on. Jessica,
I
mean.
So you're still going to be able to incorporate tradition with your children.
that's not ever what I was worried about. Like even if for say like I was asking would you impose it, I would be for it. You know, I was just saying where do these values collide? That's all I was concerned about in the first place. I wasn't like
right.
children won't get culture. I was just, you know, will this conflict with
right.
the values of respecting diverse cultures?
Yeah, and my argument is that it isn't. It won't.
So are we going to have this like child services agency that says we don't think you're raising your kids right, and we're going to take them away because we don't think we don't approve of the way you're raising your kids?
You're not going to be raising your
okay.
kids.
Well,
but how do you constrict them from raising their? I don't know. Like I understand what you're saying.
I mean, I think it's perfectly natural for human beings to like. I mean, all species raise their young. You know, they teach them these lessons.
Oh, there's a tremendous number of things that throughout history have been considered perfectly natural, which radicals have dashed, and this is one of those things that's going to happen. This is simply, I know, it's completely against every inclination that we seem to have, but we also have not put ourselves in situations where you've never even thought of this before, let's face it, right?
No, I thought...
Have you?
No, okay.
This is very
cultures,
new, and I can wholly appreciate that, but that...
cultures kind of have this idea. They would have a village, and their kids would run around and go to different houses and sleep wherever at night, and everybody would raise the kids, but it was different. They had a lot more freedom, and kids had more freedom in native cultures, but it was like a monoculture.
Right, yeah. Well, here's the thing. I mean, what we're doing is, yes, we are, if we were to put institutions in place that had to run around doing that all the time, and we had a situation where our society familially looked like it does now, we'd have a government that was constantly intervening, right? But we're not, you know, this is interesting, because these things didn't come up with all these other spheres, because we've already discussed revolution in kinship with regard to gender relations and in economics and in culture and things like that to some extent. But the things that we haven't already radicalized ourselves about, all of a sudden when we say, I can just pass through a lot of these things. I mean, there's 10 of them probably that I've listed already that nobody has been struck by. There's also 10 things, those are also 10 things that we've already agreed we're making dramatic changes in. Okay, so this would be something that subverts the family if we were to just implement it flat out. But if families are changing and kids are becoming empowered elements of society, empowered actors in society at earlier ages, this isn't going to be a problem. This isn't even going to be controversial someday, possibly.
What age are kids ready to become?
Well, it's a developing age.
I mean, empowered. It's like, what age are they autonomous, you know?
Birth.
Yeah.
But we're
yeah.
Are they independent? Are they independent at birth? No. Yeah, I am going to call on you. I had a feeling you had something kind of fresh to say, so I was going to try to get this out. But go ahead.
Okay. Well, I just want to say, like, I mean, I would take it even one step further. And I think this
I knew you were going to say something
that
further.
That's parents. I mean, I don't even think that you should have any, like, if why do you have to be living with the people that necessarily gave biological birth to you? I don't think that should be a given at all.
It won't.
So come on, really let me have it.
I'm sure the hell not going to let you have it. I've been saying that for a long time.
Yeah.
I totally...
I think it might be tricky to switch mothers into it first. Like, until it was common practice, there'd be a generation of mothers who were like, yeah, I guess it's true. You can choose.
I'm not going to let anybody have anything because I've been thinking for like 5 seconds, but I don't know that that's... if the silence is still consent, because I got to think.
Well, we're not making a decision, so that doesn't matter.
I'm just trying to...
We're not...
I'm just trying to...
No,
thank God we haven't, you know, we're not just blueprinting here.
One more thing. I've been a kid, you know, when I was a kid, I would make, I would make a decision on, you know, so you'd make a split-second decision, and if I had to live my, you know, I would have just left my parents, but then I might have regretted it, you know? And I don't know, I mean...
So then you regret it.
You go back. Yeah.
So
nobody would be sitting here, you know, wishing you were with your parents. They wouldn't teach you. And I think another thing.
There's an answer to almost everything you're going to bring up. It's kind of interesting.
Your thing about, like, would there be DSS or whatever? Like,
yeah.
Or social services?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I feel like we would decide, you know, if people aren't, you know, taking care of the kids that are in their care, whether they're biologically their kids or not, if, like, in every other aspect of our society, you know, it would be.
Yeah.
There would just be no, whatever for the kids, and if they're, chewing on nails, then there's not going to be anybody there to say, you know, that's not cool. But.
Well, they'll understand real quickly when they start chewing on the nail that it's pretty fucking painful.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of, The problem that we're encountering here is that we got things that we typically think have anything at all to do with age because of a preponderance of sort of some truth to that, right? So do kids wander into the highway more often than adults do? Yes. Does that necessarily lead to adults never need to be watched and never have to be completely independent? Or kids, you know, do kids need nourishment directly handed to them by their parents in a way that we visually see this all the time? Yes. However, does that mean that children are less dependent than adults are? Well, an adult is going to have an easier time off in the forest foraging and this and that. But that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't say that adults are less dependent. We're all dependent on each other in the society that we're talking about. There are certain matters of degrees, but beyond that, there's really nothing you can point out and say.
There's even
you're going to try, though. No, go ahead.
I don't know. I have to disagree on this point. You know, I think there's just facts where it's just like, you know, the bond between parent and child is strong. You know,
and it's biological.
Yeah, there's
it
actually,
is.
There's actually
see that now you're getting into the realm of offensive.
Yeah, bullshit.
Okay,
I'd say my father's my girlfriend's dad.
Okay, well, I'm saying, like...
Okay. I was just in North Carolina, we had
All right, I have to move on, so... I just... The idea that these things are biological, I think, has already been proven, anecdotally at least, in situation after situation, millions of them, to not be true. Parents who have this so-called natural inclination to, you know, whatever, murder their children all the time. In fact, parents murder their children at a higher rate than husbands murder their wives, at a higher rate than white people murder people of color, dramatically higher. And in some instances, like 10, 20, 30 times as high. So if there's a natural bond there, there's a strong natural inclination to violate that bond. And it's a load of shit. I mean, it's factually, because you're putting it forth as a fact, and the fact actually is so far from the truth that it does slide into the realm of being, you know, way, way out there.
I wouldn't say as a rule that parents murder their children. I mean, that's like, I mean, I don't know.
I didn't say that that's
this
a rule.
This is like your opinion, and this is like,
yeah, I know.
We're
talking about our vision, and I understand. I mean, maybe I'll come around, but to me, I read in my biology textbook or whatever, you know, after a mother has a child, this rush of endorphins go to her brain, you know, when she sees a child, she feels this like love for the child, you know.
Okay.
It's true.
It's absolutely true, and I've actually seen studies that say that. I don't know if we're talking about the same ones. They also have the same effect, believe it or not, when the person who isn't biologically the mother of that child holds the child, they also have the same physiological reaction. So it's nothing.
Yeah.
It's
mothers eat their children.
Yeah.
But the thing of adoptions, like that's how I'm biologically.
What I'm not trying to do here is antagonize that. What I am trying to do is point out that there's actually this broad base of, well, you know, I'll be mushy here, love, throughout, you know, among different types of people for different people in society.
I just want to make sure.
And that's what we need to look at, is that we have that going for us. Not that, oh my God, if we take a mother from a child because the mother is being an authoritarian freak, that we're doing something wrong, but that, look at this, we actually have an entire society that has the ability to care for children. Why would we focus on a mother's right to dominate her child when what we should be looking at is the child's right to explore life?
Well, we're done.
Okay, but
just my concern is I don't want kids to get fucked. You know what I mean? Because I think it's important
for
kids to have parents.
Yeah, I know. Well, sure. And I'm not. And I don't think that isn't your interest. I realize that's your interest. It's also my interest too. And as long as we can mutually recognize that, we talk about this for hours. If I didn't think that was your intention, I would have shut you up a long time ago. But anyway, the reason that I didn't, actually, is because I think that this stuff is really important, getting onto strategy, which is what we really need to talk about now. We're going to have this vision mean anything to us other than that, wow, wouldn't it be great if that society came as the result of somebody being able to wave a wand? Then we're going to have to talk about the realistic ability to get there. And the reason I ended off with education and the nurturing and socialization of children is that I think that that is one of the fundamental elements that overlaps between strategy and what we need to do now and what our vision is in the future. And also, it's one area where we have a tremendous amount of ability to have actual direct effect. where we can actually put some of our ideals in place, and are in countless places all over the society, in media as well, where we're doing alternative media. That's where we can put our principles into the form of institutions and into the form of practices that aren't even necessarily institutional, and that's where we are going to see change coming about. The most important factor is going to be that we need this freedom, we need this information, right? That's not the most important factor, but the initial factor. We need the awareness raising. And that's going to happen through media. It's going to happen through various forms of education. I want to, before we get into specific institutions, I want to address one issue, which I'm going to put under the title of vanguardism. In vanguardism, and I'm not talking about specific vanguards that have existed in history, but I'm definitely talking about the idea of vanguardism, which is that a political system or a political elite of any kind what do you think I'm talking about with vanguardism? Well, yeah, but I don't mean the specific one, but like the type of activity that they engage in.
Just a like professional revolutionaries trying to coordinate a revolution of stupid masses is kind of the.
Okay, exactly. I couldn't have said it better myself. Actually, that's what we're concerned with. It isn't that they're going to become the future. That it's guaranteed that they're going to become the future rulers, but that alone isn't the problem. The problem is that they're going to direct the course of the revolution. And they're going to do it from a formal setting of authority. And that's the main problem. So, of course, the course of the revolution is going to lead them into be rulers. That's guaranteed. But it's guaranteed by this sort of process that says you get to direct us. So what we want to avoid is having the polity that we begin forming now. And we're going to talk about why we need to begin developing political institutions today that we're going to lead into being the institutions of the future. But in the process of doing that, we don't want these political institutions to be the ones that guide revolution in the other spheres.